Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Is that what he gave me? Are you going first?
All right, I'll go first. Okay. Here's one I just cooked up. Farrow and Ball paint colour or song by Tyrannosaurus Rex? I'm quite pleased with this. Is it an expensive matte finish popular in Kensington, or is it a cosmic tune by the bopping elf of Steve Peregrine Took? All right. I've got 10 of them, Dave. You've got to guess. Is it a Farrow and Ball paint colour or is it a Tyrannosaurus Rex track?
Okay.
Number one, elephant's breath. It works, doesn't it? Elephant's breath. Is that a paint colour or is that a Mark Bolan tune?
I can't believe it. Oh, good grief. I'm going to say paint
colour. No, there are 10 of these. Put yourself together.
I'm going to say paint colour.
Oh, annoyingly, you've got it right. It is an uplifting mid-grey with a hint of magenta that can become almost lilac in the cooler light of west-facing rooms, according to Farrow and Ball's website. That's very good. All right, number two, dragon's ear.
That's Tyrannosaurus Rex.
It is. It's a track from A Beard of Stars. 2 out of 2 so far. Oh, Lord. No, that's very good. Okay, 3. Charlotte's Locks. Charlotte's Locks.
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
It's not. No, it takes its inspiration from the flame red hair of our head of creative.
Oh,
brings
good
a playful late 70s look. This deep and dramatic orange is particularly spectacular when used in small areas with sharp contrast. You know what I mean? All right, come on. Nancy's Blushes.
That's Farrow and Ball.
That is Farrow and Ball. True pink, named after the scrumptious rosy cheeks of a much-loved little girl called Nancy. There we go. Okay, Chariots of Silk.
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yes, it's from unicorns.
Anything with chariots in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's from unicorns. Okay, Trelawney Lawn.
That's Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yeah, it is.
So I kind of remember
that. You probably remember that track, and actually as I did too, but I just thought it sounded like it might be a shade of green.
It's from
Prophets, Seers and Sages, the Angels of the Ages. Yeah.
Excellent.
Stark handsome eyes decide the unicorn is a beast of borrowed wisdom. A little quote from it there. Okay, Mouse's Back.
That's Farrow and Ball.
Yes, it is. A shade of green that's quiet in nature and feels soft in rooms both large and small. I love their website. It's so funny. Okay, Lofty Skies.
Oh, Farrow and Ball.
No, it's A Beard of Stars. See, Lofty Skies actually could be any number of colours, actually, but actually it's a track from A Beard of Stars. Right. 2 to go. Eastern Spell.
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yes. Prophets, Seers and Sages. And the last one is Savage Ground.
Oh, good grief.
grief. Oh.
Yeah, I can hear finger symbols. I can hear.
Pharaoh ball.
Yes, I've tried to mislead you there.
Trying to throw me.
It is the yellow-based stone hue first created as a background colour for our wallpapers, but quickly added to our paint collection by popular request. Savage grief. Dave, I think you got 9 out of 10. That is
I don't think it is.
That's very
now, listen,
good.
We didn't collude over this at all, did we?
No, we didn't.
Because you don't know what I'm about to give you now, do you?
No idea at all.
Because it now might seem as if we colluded. Okay, I have a number of names here. Are they the names of acts who appeared at Feminist Acoustic Festival Lilith Fair?
Oh, right, okay.
Or are they ethical beauty products from online retailer Lush? Okay.
How bizarre. They're almost exactly the same. That's funny. Oh, that's so good. Lilith Fair.
Are the acts who appeared at Lilith Fair or vegetarian beauty products from Lush? Okay.
That's terribly good. Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Go on.
There will just be a brief pause.
While you replug in your headphones.
Okay. It should be working again. It is. Okay. First one. Wild strawberries.
Oh, my God, these are brilliant. That's fantastic. I'm saying already that that's a vegetarian body product, actually.
No, it's not. It's not. It's a Canadian group fronted by husband and wife team. Okay.
Oh, okay, okay.
Moving on. Snow Fairy. Is that an act who appeared at Lilith Fair or a vegetarian beauty product from Lush?
Beauty product.
Yes, it's body spray.
Okay. These are superb. They are really, really, really good.
Next one. Here we go. Yeah. Mud Girl. Act who appeared at Lilith Fair or vegetarian beauty.
I can see Mud Girl with her acoustic guitar. Yeah, am I right?
You're right. She's
a pair of army fatigue trousers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kim Bingham. Yes, that's the girl.
That's great.
Moving on. Next on the bill. Rose Jam. Is that an act who appeared at Lilith Fair? Or a vegetarian beauty product from Lush?
Rose Jam. This is brilliant. Rose Jam. I think, again, it's an act. I think there's several of them. One's got a violin. One's got a squeeze box. I don't know. There's a string bass. Am I right?
No, it's a shower gel. Okay.
Superb.
Moving on. Next one. Is this an act to appear at Lilith Fair or a vegetarian beauty product from Lush? Winter Bloom.
That's a product. That surely is. I see that in the bar.
No, it's not. It's a five-piece acoustic band put together for the occasion, Winter Bloom.
This is genius, Dave. These are so good. Mine were kind of rumbleable, but these are absolutely, you've got no idea. Go on.
Two to go. Breath of God. Is that an act to appear at Lilith Fair?
That's got to be an act. You couldn't possibly call anything breath. I mean, that's just so sort of nebulous.
That just shows you would never get a job in the marketing department of Lush, Mark, because that is a perfume which is divinely enlightened.
We've both done almost exactly the same thing. It's just so funny. We've both been going to these websites trying to find ludicrous quotes. That's brilliant. I love the way this works, though. It's an act, a little effect. It's not. It's a shower chair. That's right. Go on.
And finally, sparkly pumpkin. Sparkly pumpkin.
Well, that is an act. Sure, that's a sparkly pumpkin. Yeah, no. she's got a jester's hat on.
No, it's not.
And, and she's playing a banjo-lele.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's a combination of juniper berry, lime, and grapefruit oils, Mark. There you go.
That is fantastic. That is the... Well, look, you win. Hands down, you win. That is just brilliant. Oh, well done.
That follows in the footsteps, the one that you did last week. What was the one? What was it about?
Oh, that was IKEA furniture, item of IKEA furniture or Norwegian metal. Black metal band black or something. Metal. That's right. I know. It started a whole trend, isn't it?
Oh, hilarious.
There's a lot of potential there, I think. Waddy has legs.
So you haven't been tempted to put in a bid for Michael Jackson's Neverland, which was knocked out this week for very much a knockdown prize, wasn't it? Was it like $20
million? $22 million, that's right. We're originally priced at $100 million. How they come to these figures, I have absolutely no idea. But no, I mean, that. I think it's an interesting story, that. I really do. Because he bought Neverland, didn't he, in 1988.
Well, he made it, didn't he?
And he kind of made it. Yeah, it's just off of Santa Barbara. It's Santa Barbara County, isn't it? And he 2,500-acre ranch. He put in 3 railroads, an electric train, a Ferris wheel, a pirate ship, a roller coaster, bumper cars. Do you remember this? An arcade. And I think I'm right, there are lots of monkeys, and I think there might have been llamas too. So, 4-acre lake with a waterfall. So
was there an estate agent at the time that he was making these moves that said, Michael, you know, I think this might affect his resale value in some way? You know, the number of people who, you know, the market of people who want houses with 3 railroads is quite limited. Yeah. Even in California.
And a llama pen. That's right. And a roller car. And bumper cars. There's not a lot of call for it. Also the estate agent or the advisor could have said to him, can you afford this?
Well, clearly.
Unless I remember wrongly, he still owed $28 million on the place a year before he died, didn't he?
Well, yeah.
So they were threatening to throw him out. And I can remember reading a piece about it. It was actually really sad, saying how dilapidated and kind of rather wretched it was. These miserable-looking monkeys wandering around the place. Really pissed-off-looking llamas, you know. Can you imagine a sort of a zoo, basically, on the way down? You know, it's not appetizing, is it, really?
It isn't.
It's a pretty grim prospect.
That's true. Because, actually, rock stars as a breed have form when it comes to starting things with grand plans on the domestic front and then not having the staying power to see them through.
It's Toad Hall. Oh, a caravan. Hang on, what's that? It's a motor car. It's an aeroplane.
Was it you that told me the story about somebody going to interview Chris Squire?
Yeah.
As his house, and he had loads of...
It was Greg Lake, actually. It's Greg Lake. Chris Salovich went to interview him. Greg Lake, he'd been on a massive great estate in Devon, a sort of baronial pile with kind of, you know, you can imagine with kind of quad bikes on the lawn, all those kind of rock star things, you know, lots of kind of ancestral you know, gear to decorate the place. And he said when he saw him later, I think it was only rented, he saw him later, he interviewed him in, you know, I think it was somewhere like Wimbledon in a semi-detached, there was one solitary suit of armour in the hallway. You had to sort of squeeze past it to get into the kitchen. I know. But I interviewed Michael Jackson in 1983, actually, for Smash Hits, one of the last interviews. I think the second last interview you ever gave, actually. Came on to the Mirror. And then there was a film one as well. Right. But and he even then was living in an incredibly extravagant place with a 35-seater private cinema. I can remember thinking that was amazing at the time. Yeah. And he watched E.T. on this the whole time. Had, oh Lord, pyjama parties. And and he had, the other thing was, he had an animatronic display built in his house and gardens by Disney of the Pirates of the Caribbean. So at any time of day, you could go in there, press a button, and these kind of robotic ships would kind of lurch into action. There'd be cannon smoke and stuff. That's peculiar, isn't it?
I don't even understand how that could possibly be appealing. At all.
Well, nor do I. Also, once you've seen it once, do you really want to race back and press the button again? Because you're going to... I just don't understand. You can't vary the experience, can you?
I held to the Elvis Presley school of how to amuse yourself, which was that you paid for places to be kept open or to be opened in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Just for you and your mates to go in there and enjoy that. And that's fine. And then you go to a different thing next time. But the idea of building it and then being stuck with it. Anyway, 20 million or whatever it was it went for. Because the great truth about billionaires' houses is when they buy them, they always knock them down and start again. Because they can never be happy with whatever the previous billionaire built. And so the guy who's taken it, who was a former financial advisor of Michael Jackson, says he's going to use it for land banking. Which probably means he's going to knock it down.
Knock down the lot.
Raise it.
Surely he wants those llama pens. Doesn't he want those monkey cages?
Well, you know, if anybody out there wants a llama pen or a monkey cage, get on the phone.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I see people are still arguing about whether The Beatles' And Your Bird Can Sing was written about the Rolling Stones. And it's extraordinary how these stories just keep surfacing. They have a kind of...
They're filling a vacuum, aren't they? aren't they? Because there's just nothing else. It's the idea that the most exciting stories in pop music from 50 years ago is really, really rather bizarre. There's obviously nothing else going on because that is a non-story.
It
there's
is.
Four
really.
Theories, wasn't there? One was that it was written about Frank Sinatra, which is just some idea about his. You referred to his manhood as his bird.
This
is just stupid. There's a story that Cynthia Lennon had given Lennon a clockwork gilded bird in a cage, which is sort of vaguely possible, isn't it?
It's possible.
There's the thing about Mick Jagger and your bird can sing. I mean, this is just so clunky and lame, isn't it? The idea that Marianne Faithfull had a hit. Right, it's just nonsense. And then possibly about McCartney, because he mentions you say you've seen the Seven Wonders, because McCartney famously met Dylan that time. They all smoked weed in the bathroom. You remember in the hotel?
All right.
That he'd been to Seven Levels, and he said, "I've seen all Seven Levels." I think it was Evans wrote down his every thought. But I mean, honestly, who cares?
Absolutely.
Who cares what these songs are about?
Well, we just talked about it for a few minutes, haven't we? You know,
we're dismissing it randomly.
This is how the internet works.
Well, so, you know, when we discovered that Sad Eyed Lady was about Sarah Lowndes, you know, you still didn't really know what the song was about. You still couldn't really understand the song. It was mysterious and enigmatic and really enthralling, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want these puzzles solved, must
I? No, I don't. Certainly not. Certainly
but,
not.
But the Peter Jackson clip from the montage from his upcoming edit of Let It Be, that was really riveting, wasn't it? Didn't you think?
It was.
My God, that was fantastic.
He's got his introduction. He says, it's not a trailer, is it? It says, it's not a trailer. Trailers are coming later because obviously.
Yeah, and it's not even a section of the film.
It's not
even an edit. It's just a collection of images.
It's a collection of very up images.
Yeah,
it's intended to do one thing, which is to say, when this film comes out, it won't be a kind of downer. You know, look at the Beatles at the point that they were splitting up. It will be a celebration of everything you loved about them. Which is probably, you know, I mean, you can take any, you know, if somebody gives you 50 days of film or whatever it is, you can probably edit it.
You're bound to be able to find something. Exactly.
You can do whatever you want with it. Do you remember Mark Lewison told me, was it this time last year? I can't remember. No, because the Beatles started filming for Let It Be in immediately after Christmas. 1970, Mark?
No, 69.
Okay. That means that in 2019, Mark Lewiston had somehow got hold of all this stuff to look at and was going through everything on the day 50 years later.
Yeah, he told us that's right.
That it had been done. So he started at the time of day that they all started it.
You know?
And went through it in real time. He said it's absolutely astonishing to be able to do that because they shot so much.
Well, it's 56 hours, isn't it? I mean, he made that, Peter Jackson made that First World War film, They Shall Not Grow Old, out of 100 hours of footage. So this is very much his kind of his thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting because, you know, we all got the impression from the... I never saw it. Do you ever see the original? I never saw it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did you? I never saw it.
I saw it a few times.
But you got the impression from that it was tense, it was fractious, it was the Beatles falling apart, wasn't it? Paul was domineering, John was kind of snide and negative, George was put upon and resentful, and Ringo is being kind of stolidly diplomatic, you know. But this is great, isn't it? You get this lovely bits of John and Paul waltzing together.
They're
kind of holding hands at one point, you know. You get them reading out, singing a story from a newspaper about George Harrison being busted, I think it is, you know. And just seeing the four of them together playing with Billy Preston, you know, playing Get Back is absolutely wonderful. George in his pink striped trousers, Ringo clearly leading the fray, and he's kind of amazing. He's wearing a green suit at one point. You get Linda and Yoko together. You get shots from the outtakes from the Savile Row.
Yes, they're very... Oh. Listen, you know as well as I do, anything involving the Beatles' legacy has to have something in there that satisfies all the political requirements.
Yeah.
And that clip, that very brief clip of Linda and Yoko sharing a joke is clearly put there for a reason, isn't it? You know what I mean? You've got to have that in there. You know,
yeah,
I think they always do that kind of thing. It's all very equally, you know, apportioned to the four of them. And you know, George Martin's there, Mal Evans is there, Glyn Johns is there.
Yes, they're all in there.
Floating in. And I mean, I thought the most, I thought it was fantastic to look at. And I thought
you're going to mention Yoko, aren't you?
No, well,
I wasn't.
Okay, go on over to you.
No, I was going to say the thing that really still shocked me, actually, was that they're recording Get Back, and they're in a little circle, aren't they? You're really close to each other, literally 10 feet apart. And sitting smack in the middle is Yoko Ono. Now, okay, if she was going to be there, you know, she could have been there on the fringes, couldn't she? She could have been behind the glass somewhere. She could have been in the corner of the room. She's literally sitting in the middle of the Beatles. And I've convinced myself now, I've got a new theory about it. First, I was kind of just really rather outraged by this imposition. And I wonder how she feels about it too, actually. Although, of course, she's got her theories, hasn't she? One of her theories is that without me, John wouldn't have come to the recordings of the White Album.
Which may be true.
And Abbey Road, because he didn't want to go back to the studio. So those records might not have existed with them. It's quite an interesting counter theory. But no, my theory about this is that actually, I think it changes the tenor of the thing enormously, because John Lennon, in those clips that he uses, is making a concerted effort to kind of puncture any tension, isn't he? He's just clowning about. He's putting on accents. He's doing
something.
That's true. And I think he might have been, and he looks actually incredibly self-conscious about the fact that she's there. I mean, whether or not he wants her there, I don't know, but she's there, and he's therefore got to do something to kind of get around it, you know. And so he's incredibly animated in all that stuff, isn't he? Just constantly playing to the gallery. He's playing to her,
true.
Actually.
That's true.
So it's just a thought that actually, appalling though it appears to be, it might have actually in some ways produced a slightly more positive atmosphere. I don't know, because he's making an effort, isn't he? He's trying to kind of lead the charge.
That's true. But I mean, Yoko's, you know, sitting in that circle is, you know, if you look up passive aggressive in the dictionary, they ought to just say, see Yoko Ono.
Just a photograph of her.
in the filming of Let It Be.
No.
It's just an astonishing thing to do, because as you say, there's nothing wrong with being there. There's loads of, you know, husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever, have been there, but they're just sitting off to one side, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
They're very aware that the shot that they shouldn't get in, you know.
Yeah.
But no.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say the thing that really interested me over and above, I very much enjoyed seeing it, is the key, is the combination of the release of this clip, this montage, and the final caption, which is in cinemas 2021.
Yeah.
Now, right now, that's a bold prediction. But I think what they're saying is, if we can't get this in cinemas, is it worth it? You know what I mean? Because it's very moving to see the four of them together, enjoying themselves in pictures you haven't seen before, in really high quality shots, really high quality. They look hyper real. You think, my God, that's John Lennon. It could have been done today.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't look as if it belongs in the 60s or the 70s or whatever. It could have been done today. And I think if they can release that into cinemas, if cinemas were open, I think huge numbers of people who don't go to the cinema would go.
It would be a major event.
Just to see it on a big,
huge
screen. Whereas if it just popped up on Apple TV or Netflix or whatever, it's just another nice thing that's on your telly, isn't it? You know, but it has no event status.
It's,
you know,
it's very much a film that you want to watch with other people. Isn't
yeah,
in fact, the fact that you and I are sitting here talking about it, and lots of our pals have been talking about it, it just shows you how much of a communal thing it is. Because all those people over the last 50 years who've picked up on the Beatles and discovered the Beatles, they're all interested.
And, you know, old gits like me would go. I'm not readily go to the cinema. It's funny. I've just been reading in the last few days David Thompson's book, The Whole Equation, which is about Hollywood. and about what Hollywood meant, what Hollywood brought to people. And his whole obsession is you're with other people in the dark.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah.
You're seeing your dreams in the dark together with loads of other people who are seeing their dreams as well. That's the magic thing about it. And it's not the same.
Not the same seeing how you're looking. No.
Not the same at home.
No.
You know, there would be a great kind of, there's a great, you know, common feeling of emotion around looking at the Beatles, even after this time, that there simply isn't about anything else, I don't think.
I couldn't agree more. Did I tell you about my interview with Michael Lindsay Hogg? I can't remember. Did I interview him in 2015? He was really, really interesting about Let It Be. He was saying that the original plan, you probably know this actually, was that they were going to go to an amphitheater off the coast of Tunisia. Do you remember this?
No.
This was the whole idea. The whole thing was it was going to be a performance movie. Yeah. It was going to build up to a performance. And the plan was they were going to go out to Tunisia. They were going to sail out there. They were going to take some of the audience with them. And he said, you know, I just looked it up. He said, the idea was to start filming at 6 a.m. with people setting up the kit. And the audience would arrive across the desert by jeep, by camel. The Beatles would start playing around midnight. So, but it just wasn't possible. So eventually they had to do it in Savile Row. So they got 11 cameras. Amazing, 11 cameras. Is it? Some on the roof of the building across the road, two or three in the street. But at 12 noon, I realized that the Beatles still hadn't decided whether they're going to go ahead. They were at the bottom of the stairs. And Paul said to me, he said, let's do it. Let's go. And George Harrison said, what's the point? Oh. And Ringo said, it's cold up there. And it was.
Yeah.
Said, and then John said, fuck it, let's do it. And they did it. And they had a really good time. And they said they rocked and they rolled like they had them when they were teenagers. They loved it. They didn't want the police to stop them. And that was really interesting. That the whole thing was in the balance, wasn't it? You know, that I'm not sure if it hadn't been rained off the day before, actually, because the weather was so terrible. They built that little stage for them. They got everyone there. They got the studio set up. Still didn't know if they were going to do it.
We'd been there. Did you and I go up on that roof?
We did. I've been up there twice, actually. I was up there for the Bootleg Beatles did a version of the set on whatever anniversary it would have been. I can't think how many years after the event it would have been. I went for that. It was very funny. I can remember standing there with Glenn Matlock. But you and I have been up there too, yeah.
Well,
number 3 Savile Row.
Yeah. Loads of bands have done rooftop concerts ever since, have they? Didn't Jimmy Percy and Sham 69 do one over Oxford Street? You two did one LA. Yeah.
Echo and the Bunnymen did the HMV.
HMV, yeah, they did.
Well, I think we were Q, I think.
Anyway.
Sham 69 rooftop. It doesn't have quite the same ring. I don't know why not.
So anyway,
lace up boots and corduroys.
In cinemas 2021.
Yeah.
Boldly predicts Peter Jackson. We shall see. Let's hope so. So in the deaths column, Leslie West.
I used to love Leslie West.
You did, didn't you?
I loved Leslie. I thought they were great, Mountain. And one of the things I really liked at the time is he had embraced his physical shape, hadn't he? He'd accepted it and decided he was going to exploit it. You either think, I'm a little bit overweight and I'm either going to do something about it or disguise it or whatever. But no. I mean, he called the band Mountain, didn't he, right? And if I'm entirely mistaken, he put out a solo album at one point called The Great Fatsby.
He did indeed. Second solo album, The Great Fatsby.
That's absolutely brilliant.
But the thing that made the thing that they're really best known for in America is Mississippi Queen, which was a huge kind of staple of FM radio in the early 70s, but probably better known in this country for Nantucket Sleigh Ride,
which I remember very fondly,
which was used surprisingly on the as the theme tune of the TV current affairs show Weekend World, which is a program I don't think I ever watched. But boy, it was trailed hundreds of times, you know, every week, you know, because it was a Sunday lunchtime thing or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. And so every time it was trailed, you heard this very, very characteristic, you know, heavy rock riff ending on this trail, which you used all the time. But Mississippi Queen was the big one in the States. And I was just, I couldn't help, I was just listening to it before we started. And I was looking at the lyrics, and it goes, Mississippi Queen, you know what I mean. Mississippi Queen, she taught me everything. went down around Vicksburg, around Louisiana way, where lived the Cajun lady aboard the Mississippi Queen. You know she was a dancer, she moved better on wine. While the rest of them dudes were getting their kicks, boy, I beg your pardon, I was getting mine. It was that kind of thing. It was, and those lyrics, let me tell you, took four people to write.
Okay. Oh, my Lord.
It's absolutely extraordinary. David Rea. Felix Pappalardi, of course, was the kind of, they formed around him, didn't they? Because he was the link to Cream.
He was the link to Cream because he formed a group with Jack Bruce and Cookie Lane, didn't he?
It's more involved than that because later on there was West Bruce and Lane.
That's it.
Which was Leslie West, Jack Bruce, and Cookie Lane, who was the drummer.
Yeah.
From Mountain, wasn't he?
You know, yeah, he was.
They kept that whole thing going for years, you know, because Cream had obviously just broken up and disappeared. Just at the moment, there was a huge appetite for them, for that kind of sound.
For that power trio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
there were Mountain. They were Mounted to minister to it. So, Leslie West.
And he made a lot of money in the end out of samples, didn't he?
He had a
track Long Red, which was a psychedelic blues, just sampled by De La Soul,
Kanye
West, and Jay-Z. So he made a lot of money in the end.
Well,
it certainly kept going anyway.
The other thing is Mississippi Queen is it seems to me the ultimate more cowbell tune, isn't it? If you go and listen to it, it just starts with a cowbell, you know,
Honky Tonk Women.
Well, it's Honky Tonk. It's like also the one that the led to the kind of viral video was, it's Don't Fear the Reaper, wasn't it, by Blue Oyster Cult?
Yeah.
It became the distinguishing mark of a truly brainless rock and roll anthem, didn't it? You know, cowboy. You've got to give it more cowboy.
Cigarette lighters out. We hear absolutely. The cowboy.
Yeah.
I know. So, do you remember what a Nantucket sleigh ride was?
Well, it's a whaling term, isn't it?
Yeah, whaling. I think if you harpooned a whale, and you were in the boat, and the whale set off, and you were then towed by the whale, and that's it, unbelievably terrifying experience because you're presumably thinking it might dive at any moment. It was called a Nantucket sleigh ride. I've always thought that was rather romantic, actually.
There were no safe gigs on the whaling.
I don't think so. There was no easy no. Well, I mean, you could imagine you could have stayed in the kitchens and made the soup, but I mean, otherwise, you know, there's nowhere to hide.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I tell you what, I was looking at, do you know what was number one at Christmas 40 years ago?
So that's 1980, right? 1980.
Yes.
Not Cliff, obviously. Was it a novelty record?
Kind of, yes, yeah. Because I would have thought it was...
Winifred School Choir?
Well, there you go. That's absolutely correct.
Was it them? My God.
You remember that, Alex? Do you remember the Winifred School Choir?
My mum's middle name is Winifred.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Very good.
Good work.
There's no one quite like Grandma, because I always assumed it would be just like Starting Over, because, you know, this is obviously just after John Lennon had died, and Just Like Starting Over had been number one. This apparently supplanted it. Anyway, 1981, Christmas number one. I want to know how many of these are familiar to you, because I think there'll be a pattern will emerge as we get nearer to the present time, okay? 1981, Human League, Don't You Want Me? Everybody remembers that?
Absolutely. It was. Yeah, what a great one.
Following year, less great, Rene and Renato, Save Your Love. Do you remember that, Alex?
Yes.
Doesn't even remember that. The following year, 1983, Flying Pickets, Only You. Is it a cappella version of...
Classic.
Of it was a Yazoo song, wasn't it?
Yazoo song,
a Vince Clarke song, sung by a bunch of a cappella actors. And it was a number one for what seemed like months.
Huge hit.
Anything
huge.
To go about. So obviously what was number one in 1984 Christmas would be clearly...
Band-Aid.
That's absolutely correct. Band-Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas. The following year, Shaking Stevens with Merry Christmas, Everyone. The year after that, puzzlingly, I don't know why this happened, Jackie Wilson's Ancient Rite Petite was the number one...
It must have been in an ad, mustn't it?
It must have been in an ad.
It must be in something, sort of denim jeans ad or something like that.
So that's 1986. So 1987 was, somebody was a number one, is known to us personally.
Pet Shop Boys?
Pet Shop Boys, always on my mind.
Always on my mind, that's right.
And the following year, Cliff Richard, obviously, Mistletoe and Wine. And then the following year, 1989, it's amazing to be reminded of this, Band-Aid 2 was a number one with Do They Know It's Christmas Again. Extraordinary, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is.
Then Cliff Richard was back there in 1990, Saviour's Day. 1991, it was Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, These Are the Days of Our Lives. Whitney Houston, 1992, I Was Always Love You. 1993, who could forget Mr. Blobby?
Oh, classic. Stone Cold Banger.
Now, that's the first time you've pricked your ears up since 1980, Alex. So that just shows you what really makes an impact, doesn't it? Yeah.
Stone Cold Banger. 1994, I pulled my thing out of my earphones once again. It was amazingly to recall. It was Stay Another Day by East 17.
Oh, man.
Good Lord.
Yes.
Well, it's a good tune, Stay Another Day.
I still get a little bit emotional whenever that comes on the radio.
And of course, why was it a Christmas number one? Because it had what?
Sleigh bells.
Sleigh bells? Well, bells.
Brian Harvey.
Them sleigh bells, the bells on Stay Another Day were altogether more bigger and more sonorous, I think.
Yeah.
1995, one of the worst records that's ever been Christmas number one, in my opinion, was Michael Jackson's Earth Song. It's unbelievable.
Oh, it's an awful song.
It's a dreadful record.
It's a dreadful song, the one that Jarvis Cocker advertised his feelings for.
So the following three...
MTV
Awards. He did. The following 3 years, the same act had the Christmas number one. Three separate number ones.
Take that.
No. In 1996, 1997, and 1998.
God, I can't get that because it wouldn't be Kylie. It wouldn't be anyone like that, would it? Who would that have been? Spice Girls.
There you go, what? Spice Girls.
Yeah,
Spice Girls, absolutely correct. One, Too Much, and then Goodbye. Following year, 1999, Westlife, I Have a Dream. And here, and then we enter the current century, and still things start going very odd, I think. In year 2000, Bob the Builder, Can We Fix It, was a number one.
I remember it very well.
You probably bought that, Alex, didn't you? You probably insisted your mum bought it for you. and then 2001, Robbie Williams and Nicole Kidman singing Something Stupid.
Oh my lord.
Was that from... Was that? Oh, I'm sorry. Is it Moulin Rouge?
Big album, I think. Swing Winning.
Sorry? Oh, was that? Okay.
I think so.
Okay. And then 2002, Girls Aloud, Sound of the Underground. 2003, Gary Jules. You remember that? Mad World?
Yeah.
Donnie Darko?
Yeah.
Keith Drummond used to be obsessed with that. And then, once again, 2004, Band-Aid 20. Are back with Christmas number one again. Do They Know It's Christmas?
That was a version with Dizzy Rascal on it, wasn't it?
It probably was.
Yeah, they made a little rap section for him, and it was great. It's a Dizzy thing.
I don't remember that. I'd like to hear that. There's a rap section on Do They Think It's Christmas? Yeah, It's Christmas. That's fantastic.
2005, Shane Ward, That's My Goal, of whom I have no memory whatsoever.
I think he's a member of Westlife, or was.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
2006, Leona Lewis, A Moment Like This. 2007, Leon Jackson, When You Believe. 2008, Alexandra Burke, Hallelujah. We're now in the...
I was going to say, your theory is starting to be proved, Dave, is that these are enormously unmemorable, aren't they? Now we get to the point where we don't know who any of these are. I just don't even remember them being played. I can't hear them in my head.
2009, Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name, of course.
Wonderful.
2010, Matt Cardle, When We Collide.
He was an X Factor person, I think.
He was.
Oh, right, okay.
2011, The Military Wives with Gareth Malone, with Wherever You Are. 2012, The Justice Collective, He Ain't Heavy, Is My Brother. And then 2013, I could be making this up now, couldn't I? Sam Bailey and Skyscraper. Does that mean anything to anybody? No.
No, no.
2014, Ben Hanau and Something I Need. No. I'm aware in 2015 the Lewisham and Greenwich NHS Choir was number one, A Bridge Over Trouble, A Bridge Over You. 2016, Clean Bandit with Rockabye. 2017, Ed Sheeran with Perfect. And then the last 3 years, including this year, have been the same act.
Oh, Lad Baby, isn't it?
There you go.
Lad. No, I had absolutely no
there you
idea.
Go. There you go.
I am officially out of the loop.
Well, you see,
Lad
I think,
Baby's oeuvre, I'm not fully aware
but,
of.
But I think... I think
across Lad Baby.
The great truth of this is that most of the nation's out of the loop.
Indicating that how many copies are Lad Baby selling? Very,
well,
very
it's,
few.
It's not selling, is it?
No, it's
God,
exactly.
God knows what. You know, so tell us about Lad Baby, Alex, because they're, you know, they've been the nation's favourite in the last three Christmases. Don't Stop Me Eating, I Love Sausage Rolls, and We Built the City.
Right. Oh, yes, We Built the City on Sausage Rolls, wasn't it? Was that the one?
Sure, yeah, that was the one. I don't think I've actually heard any of Lad Baby's songs, actually. But I'm pretty sure that he was in my year at uni. I'm 84% sure that Lad Baby was in my lecture hall.
So you're let's get this straight, Alex. You did a course at university on the kind of music business, didn't you?
Yeah, I did music industry management and marketing. Well, that was the official line. Actually, I did going to the student union every day. But,
okay. But let me, I just want to, this is interesting.
Yeah.
So you had a whole year's intake of doing music, business, industry, and market.
3 years.
Okay. And you all sat there, and some of them were like you, Alex, you know, they wanted to play in a rock band and wanted to be involved in all kinds of things. And then you no doubt had somebody, people who wanted to be managers or whatever. And they all had their serious desires. What they didn't know at the time was that the one person who would do far better than anybody else would be the person who had a stupid idea about sausage rolls.
But that's the nature of a Christmas hit a lot of the time, isn't it? It's just that one gag, you know.
It's the nature of the music business.
Totally. It's just a kind of quirky. You know, you barely need to make the song. You just need to the gag. It works on its own, doesn't it? We built the city on sausage rolls. It's
perfect. But we didn't do it, Mark, did we? We didn't.
No. You know, the Lad Baby is now living in some massive pile in the country.
Yeah. Sat on that idea for 15 years, you know? He was at Dougie's Sandwich Emporium back in 2004.
He used to sit in the back of the lectures just making notes to himself. Sausage rolls.
Sausage rolls. It works.
Oh, well. So there you go. That's our trip through the Christmas number ones from ubiquity to obscurity in 40 years. That's what's happened to the Christmas number one. So any other business, Alex, we've got to talk about?
We have some new patrons.
Good. Always nice to have new patrons.
They are Carl Parker.
Very good, Carl. Excellent. Bloody. Welcome aboard.
Blaine Allen.
Very good. Superb. Nice to see you, Blaine.
Peter Carlin.
Oh, Peter Carlin, who we talked to only the other day. Yeah,
got an interview with. Yeah. Great man.
Chris Carroll.
Good. Nice to see you, Chris.
And these are all annual patrons.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Discount if you subscribe annually. And we also have Tony Flattery.
All right. Hello, Tony.
David Cook.
David, hello.
Who's an Access All Areas patron.
Oh. And
who will be visiting on his birthday.
All right. Okay.
Good. I hope so.
And Matty Hebditch.
Well, very nice. Very nice to see them all.
What a lot of fun those birthday visits are. We really enjoyed them.
Really good.
That's part of the package, isn't it?
That's part of the package.
Us appearing down your digital chimney and rummaging through your record collection.
We're very delighted to be joined by a load of people actually on Christmas Day at 5 o'clock or whatever time we did it. 5 o'clock on Christmas Day. People showing us what Santa had brought them.
That really was a hoot, wasn't it? Everyone had a glass of ginger wine. Everyone had a kind of, paper hat and a jaunty tilt. And the highlight, surely, was somebody producing... we'd never heard of it. Was it a Ziggy Starduck?
It was Ziggy Stardust.
It was. I mean, that's fantastic.
Which had been given by his son. Yeah. So it was nice to do all that. And we got, you know, loads more things going on over the next few weeks, haven't we, Alex? Because every period is festive when you're stuck indoors.
The fun never sets.
So what's coming up over the next week, Alex?
Well, you've got a couple of Word New Attics in the can. We've got Peter Carlin coming up and also Glenn Coulson.
Glenn Coulson.
Oh, yeah, good.
So, you know, memories of Ian Dury and Viv Stanchel and Peter talking about his books about Bruce Springsteen and Paul Simon and Warner Brothers, Peter from the United States. And so there'll be more in that vein coming up over the next few weeks. The quiz returns.
Of the quiz, absolutely.
Returns on Friday.
Returns of the first quiz of 2021.
Oh, God, that's New Year's. Oh, it's New Year's Day, isn't it? Yeah,
it's New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And at its usual slot at 6 o'clock. And as we say, we wipe the slate clean because the final, we had a cumulative winner on our last quiz, which was a week ago, just before Christmas. Matt Button, I think, carried away the special ceremonial pork pie from Brace Cottage.
And was very thrilled about it, loudly
very pleased, on Twitter. Very pleased about that.
Bless him.
So we shall start the running again in 2021. So make sure if you're one of those people who got onto the quiz late in the day and thought, I'm never going to get on the leaderboard, well, now's your chance, because we're starting all over again. All bets are off.
All bets are off.
Starting next Friday. In what is bound to be a happier new year.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.